Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone. It is Tuesday, the 22nd day of October in the year 2024. And I thank you very much for joining me today for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglowitz, and I'll be reading from today's edition of the paper, along with related articles that may have appeared within the last 2 or 3 days. We'll begin with an article that comes to us from Arivaca, Arizona, and is submitted by staff writer Francine Kiefer and staff photographer Riley Robinson. Their article is titled, "In Arizona, Voters Want Tighter Borders. Will this issue swing the election?" In the battleground state of Arizona, where the divisive issue of immigration is a top voter concern, rancher Jim Chilton and volunteer Gail Kosorik are political opposites. He's for Donald Trump. She backs Kamala Harris. He's for a border wall. She's against it. Yet they have found a way to partner on the polarizing subject of border security by working to prevent the deaths of border crossers, thousands of whom traverse Mr. Chilton's desert ranch. The two are also friends. "We have common ground on humanity. That's why he and I get along," says Ms. Kosorik, a volunteer with the Tucson Samaritans, a humanitarian group that provides water, food, and first aid along the border. "She's a terrific human," he says, with a twinkle from under his cowboy hat. The two are meeting at his cattle ranch before she sets out with a new volunteer to check out 2 aid stations along the border. Peel away the politics of border security and immigration, and ideology submits to practicality among many voters in this border state and across the United States. That's particularly true when it comes to order on the border. That's in the wake of record illegal migration that overwhelmed southern communities and northern and western cities such as New York and Denver. Trump and Harris supporters now align closely on improving security along the country's borders, according to an August nationwide survey of registered voters by Pew Research Center. Large majorities also agree on admitting more high-skilled immigrants. "Americans are more aligned generally on what they want to see from immigration than you hear from pundits, advocates, or even politicians," says Teresa Cardinal Brown, senior advisor on immigration and border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. "They want a fair process and migrants to abide by it," she says. And she adds, quote, "Majorities in both parties are perfectly fine giving folks who have been here a long time a path to legal status." But the security gap and Mr. Trump's clear dominance on this issue has forced Democrats to change their tune. 4 years ago, Joe Biden and his running mate campaigned on the humanitarian treatment of migrants. Today, Vice President Harris stresses her background as a former California prosecutor who was tough on cartels and, as president, would be equally tough on border security. When she ran for president in 2019, she promised to make illegal border crossing a civil offense. Now she pledges to pursue, quote, "more severe criminal charge against repeat violators," unquote. She also backs more restrictions on asylum. She has moderated significantly in her baseline position on immigration, says pollster David Byler of Noble Predictive Insights in Phoenix. In Arizona, as in the nation, immigration is a top voter issue, along with the economy, and polls show that voters put more trust in Mr. Trump to handle these twin concerns than they do in Ms. Harris. Trump is in his sweet spot on immigration, says Mr. Beiler. She understands that this is a weakness for her and is acting accordingly. When Mr. Trump descended that golden escalator in 2015 and promised to build a great wall on the border with Mexico, he had an immediate convert in Mr. Chilton, a fifth-generation cattle rancher. About 5.5 miles of his sprawling ranch abuts the U.S.-Mexico border. When he and his wife, Sue, bought the place nearly 40 years ago, the wall was a four-strand wire cattle fence. Today, a ribbon of Trump administration steel slats runs along most of the line that his ranch shares with Mexico. But not along all of it. Construction of the last half mile stopped with the Biden administration. That makes it an easy path for drug and human traffickers. The Chiltons and their cowboys have encountered migrants, drug drops, and drug packers who sometimes tote AK-47s. Burglary is also a problem, and discarded plastic bags can kill cattle that ingest them. Worst of all are the human deaths, a total of 35 just in the last year, including an obvious cartel beheading. Since Mr. Biden became president, the Chiltons' motion sensor cameras have recorded 3,550 migrants and drug packers crossing on their ranch, five times more than during the Trump administration. The couple want the wall finished, a point they made to thundering applause at the Republican National Convention in July. My real issue is that people die on my ranch, and that's horrifying, explains Mr. Chilton, seated at his massive dining room table in September. This is where Ms. Kosurek comes in. The Democratic precinct captain runs orientation trips for new Samaritan volunteers. The wall is a money pit, she states, charging up and down the undulating border road in her Toyota 4Runner. Summer monsoons undermine the wall so much that the Biden administration is installing French drains and paving the deeply scarred dirt track. Ms. Kosurek stops at one of the many repaired cuts in the slat wall. A witty welder has chalked the words job security with a smiley face above his latest handiwork. Further along the border, a dismantled Clinton-era barrier lies piled to one side. It wasn't high enough. Despite their different views, Ms. Kosurek praises Mr. Chilton. It was his idea to mark one of his cattle water tanks near the border with a tall blue flag so migrants could easily spot it. He has installed 29 drinking fountains at wells and on pipes. He calls her and the Samaritans, quote, big-hearted people who feel, as I do, that people shouldn't die in the desert, unquote. And they agree on this. America needs immigration reform, including more legal immigrants, because employers are going begging for workers. In this tight race, the Grand Canyon state so far tips toward former President Trump, giving him a slight average edge of 1.8 percentage points. In 2020, Mr. Biden won Arizona by fewer than 11,000 votes. But Arizonans overwhelmingly support a controversial immigration enforcement measure on the November ballot, Proposition 314, according to a poll by Noble. The measure was placed before voters by the GOP-controlled state legislature after Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed similar legislation. The catch-all proposition would make it a state crime for non-citizens to enter anywhere besides a port of entry. It would also allow local law enforcement to arrest those who crossed unlawfully and let state judges order deportations. Important to many border security advocates, the measure has a felony component relating to selling fentanyl. The measure has majority support even among traditionally liberal blocs, college-educated people, Hispanics, Democrats, and young people. It's a sizzling 110 degrees Fahrenheit in early September, and Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance is rocking a crowd of about 300 at the Phoenix Biltmore Resort. He starts by criticizing the Biden-Harris administration's, quote, open border record, and then says, quote, I bring a message from Donald J. Trump. If you are in this country illegally, in 6 months, pack your bags, unquote. Sustained applause follows before he can get to his immigration punchline. Restart deportations. Finish the border wall. Stop the catch and release of unauthorized migrants. In interviews at the rally, several Trump supporters express worry about cartels and crime. Brian Kelly, a photographer who lives in Scottsdale, recalls a harrowing incident when driving his black BMW on a dirt road. Suddenly, he was boxed in by cartel-looking old vehicles with blacked-out windows. He managed a quick escape maneuver once he reached pavement. And what of Ms. Harris's promise to get tough on the border? Does he find her believable? He laughs. Chameleon, no. She's flip-flopped so much she might as well don a MAGA hat, he says. She hasn't done anything. We haven't even seen her for the last 3.5 years, let alone trust her. In the past, a kind of bipartisan consensus existed among various groups in the two parties, says Ms. Brown of the Bipartisan Policy Center. The thinking was the way to control illegal immigration at the border was through more border patrol, technology, some amount of barrier, and the ability to quickly deport back to Mexico, where most crossers came from. As recently as 2013, after Republican Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama, the Republican National Committee recommended that the party embrace comprehensive immigration reform, with security measures paired with pathways toward legal status for unauthorized immigrants already in the country. But the going enforcement strategy that had been in place for 20-plus years broke down as new population groups arrived, Ms. Brown explains. More people from Central America, and now from much further away, started crossing, including unaccompanied minors. That opened the door for immigration and border security to become highly partisan and supercharged under former President Trump. Mr. Trump is campaigning on immigration, much like he did the first time he ran for the Oval Office. As president, he slashed refugee levels, and perhaps his most controversial move, he separated children from their families as a deterrent to illegal crossings. The Trump administration eventually backed down from its separation policy, while the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a version of what critics called the Muslim ban. He also built about 500 miles of border wall, much of it replacement fencing, and expelled migrants under a pandemic health policy. At first, border apprehensions fell, and then doubled, prompting his Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers to await their first hearings. Democrats were horrified by President Trump's deterrence policies and saw them as a humanitarian issue. That's what Mr. Biden ran on, and that's what he did in his first 2 years in office, says Ms. Brown. And the numbers went up and up and up and up and up. Consequentially, President Biden at first put deportations on pause and ended his predecessor's Remain in Mexico policy. But he continued pandemic expulsions through the end of the public health emergency in the spring of 2023. To discourage illegal crossings, the president promoted the use of an app at official ports of entry and expanded use of quote-unquote parole, which gives non-citizens temporary permission to stay, mostly on humanitarian grounds. The Biden administration has paroled more than 500,000 nationals from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, who've had to arrive via airports. Conservatives argue that the White House has overstepped its parole authority, creating a, quote, back door for otherwise unauthorized immigrants to enter the U.S. Along the southern border, the Border Patrol has tracked more than 7 million unauthorized migrant encounters during the Biden years, compared with some 2 million during the Trump administration. Beginning in June, President Biden significantly tightened access to asylum through executive action. Since then, illegal migration at the southern border has dropped precipitously and is now at its lowest levels since 2020, likely also due to stepped-up Mexican enforcement. No question, this is a difficult issue for the vice president. Mr. Beiler, the pollster, says Ms. Harris's best path is to keep doing what she's doing, sidestep her record, as she did in the debate with Mr. Trump when she baited him on crowd size, move aggressively to her right so that immigration is not a disqualifier for her, and point out to Mr. Trump's extremes, such as his demeaning rhetoric and backing of mass deportations. That seemed to work when she tried it out at her introductory rally with running mate Minnesota Governor Tim Walz in Metro Phoenix in August. Cheers and applause interrupted her multiple times when she pledged to take on the broken immigration system and fix it, promising comprehensive immigration reform, strong border security, and an earned pathway to citizenship. She excoriated Mr. Trump for tanking a bipartisan border bill in the U.S. Senate this year and choosing to run on the issue. She says she will sign the bill if elected. Having a protected border is important, says rally goer Hector Zamorano, a Mexican-American loading up with snacks at the Glendale Arena, where at least 15,000 supporters roared approval for the duo. Others interviewed agreed. Loyal Trump supporters like those at the Vance rally aren't likely to suddenly trust Ms. Harris and her new centrist message. But in a contest that hangs on the margins, that message could help her win over persuadable voters who don't like the former president, says Tyler Montague, a Republican consultant in Arizona who does not support Mr. Trump. It might give them permission to vote for her, he says. On the other hand, all the tough talk on the border is disheartening to Latinos and others who have long wanted a pathway to citizenship, particularly for quote-unquote dreamers, children of unauthorized immigrants brought to the U.S. as minors. The bipartisan Senate bill that Ms. Harris says she'd sign had nothing in it for dreamers, though it did provide funds for more border patrol and immigration courts and allow for more building of the wall. What complicates the picture even further is that while Latinos tend generally toward voting Democratic, many have conservative cultural and economic values. As a result, President Trump has made inroads with Hispanics, especially men. The group as a whole is influential, especially in swing states. In Arizona, 25% of voters are Latino. In Nevada, it's 20%. While the vice president leads Mr. Trump among Hispanics, she's not polling as well with them as did Mr. Biden, who also won Nevada. The Latino share of the electorate is growing and evolving, says Angel Molina, an associate professor at Arizona State University's School of Public Affairs. That presents a challenge for the vice president. Historically, it might have been enough to mobilize them just by taking a pro-Latino stance on immigration, he says. But today's younger voters want to know there will be follow-through. What's going to be different about this time, he asks. To that end, Dr. Molina notes that when Ms. Harris visited the border recently, she rejected the argument that you can't have both border security and an earned path to citizenship. We can do both, and we must do both, the vice president said. But is that dual track possible? Time and time again, immigration deals on the cusp of bipartisan agreement have failed. Mr. Montague says that when he talks with Republicans off the record, most want to help dreamers. He faults America's primary election system that rewards hardliners. Interestingly, Arizonans will have a chance to vote in November on a ballot measure that replaces partisan primaries with open ones. It competes with another ballot measure that anchors partisan primaries in the state constitution. But Juliana Larson isn't holding her breath for Washington to act. Just over a year ago, she founded a nonprofit, the Arizona Refugee Center, in Mesa, the third largest city in Arizona. The center, which is sandwiched into a single-story insurance building, serves as a makeshift classroom, supply center, and food bank for migrants. She, a business partner, and several volunteers handle hundreds of cases for Afghan, Venezuelan, Mauritanian, Cuban, and other asylum seekers. Most have come over the southern border. On a recent day, all of the dozen or so waiting chairs that line the refugee center's entry are occupied. In the adjoining room, an Afghan caseworker is stuck on hold trying to get a call through to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. In two nearby rooms, adults learn English by explaining how to cook their favorite foods. It's a triage every day, says Ms. Larson. The immigration solution seems obvious to her. Everyone wants a secure border. They also want people to be treated humanely. But like so many Arizonans faced with what's on their doorstep, she says she has no choice but to address the challenge at hand. I can't wait for Washington to fix anything. I have people right in front of me that need me. Should be noted that the Monitor staff writer Sarah Matusek contributed to this story. Now let's turn to an article that comes to us from Washington, submitted by staff writer Cameron Joseph. His article is titled, Elon Musk is spending big to boost Trump's turnout. Republicans worry it might flop. Tech billionaire Elon Musk has placed a huge bet on boosting former President Donald Trump's campaign ground game. But it's an open question whether that wager will actually pay off. Mr. Musk has dropped just shy of $75 million into America PAC since July, according to documents filed with the Federal Election Commission, or FEC, making him one of the biggest spending supporters of the former president in this campaign cycle. His group has spent more than $110 million in all, most of it, on the get-out-the-vote operations to boost Mr. Trump's fortunes. The new super PAC is coordinating closely with the Trump campaign to spur voter turnout in the key presidential battleground states for the former president, taking advantage of new FEC guidance that for the first time allows close coordination between campaigns and outside groups. But the brand new organization appears to be scrambling to build out a robust field program to supplement a Trump campaign field operation that's significantly smaller than it was in 2020, one that Republicans privately fret could be swamped by a robust turnout game from Vice President Kamala Harris and her allies. Turnout could well determine who wins the 2024 presidential election, which polls show is a tied race in most battleground states. Mr. Musk is known for taking big risks and novel approaches in his enterprises, from Tesla to the social platform X to SpaceX, that only sometimes pay off. And with no time for a second try, there are signs that this particular operation isn't yet where he might want it to be. With less than 3 weeks until Election Day and early voting already underway in many swing states, America PAC still listed open jobs in nearly 50 metro areas on its website as of last Thursday, though a source familiar with its operations said that just showed the group was continuing to scale up further and that it is exceeding internal metrics that were laid out in July. America PAC fired its initial vendors in July and only really ramped up its efforts in August after Mr. Musk endorsed Mr. Trump. In September, it fired and replaced its vendors in Arizona and Nevada, and has reportedly been beset by some tech problems. It's not 100% as good, probably, as they would like it to be, or would like it to be, but it's a lot of added coverage regardless, one senior Trump campaign aide says about Mr. Musk's group. Anytime you're hiring lots of people quickly and covering lots of ground, you're going to have a little bit of garbage in there, a little bit of bad performance, but it's at the margins. Others are more concerned. Republican strategists in a half dozen swing states are nationally say that while America PAC is stepping in to fill an urgent need, the late start undercuts their efforts and hurts Mr. Trump's chances. Many decline to be named for fear of being publicly critical of political allies. I am concerned about the late start and all the hiccups they've had in switching teams and vendors, says one former Trump campaign official who worked on the 2020 race. Super PACs have traditionally spent most of their money on big TV ad buys, but Mr. Musk has long been deeply skeptical of the power of advertising. Tesla has never run TV ads and saw a better opportunity to boost Mr. Trump. And on paper, it's a smart investment, since candidates themselves get much lower prices than outside groups on TV ads if Mr. Trump's campaign spends more of its hard money on ads and outside groups pick up the slack on the ground game, it can pay off. This option was created by an FEC ruling this spring that allowed candidates to coordinate much more closely with super PACs. entities that, unlike traditional political action committees, can raise and spend unlimited funds. On get-out-the-vote operations than they had previously been allowed to do. But it's much more difficult, expensive, and time-intensive to build out a field operation than to cut a few TV ads. Staff members have to be hired and trained, and then painstakingly make calls and knock on doors of people identified as likely Trump supporters. And tech failures can devastate a ground game, impacting the larger campaign. In 2012, Mitt Romney's presidential campaign poured hundreds of thousands of dollars and a lot of staff hours into Orca, a vote-targeting platform that was supposed to be a cutting-edge data operation that would let them respond in real time to information on the ground on Election Day. But Orca crashed on Election Day, leaving the campaign flying blind without critical information. Both The Guardian and The Washington Post have reported that campaign Sidekick, the app Mr. Musk's super PAC is relying on to gather data and log door knocks, has been glitchy and unreliable in areas where cell phone service is limited. According to The Guardian, when users don't have fast internet connectivity, the app forces canvassers to use offline walkbooks that lack a geo-tracking feature and don't always upload after reconnecting to strong internet, allowing hired door knockers to potentially cheat by speed-running routes and just dropping campaign materials rather than knocking on doors and talking to people. A GOP field strategist who has recently used the app says its reliability, quote, depends on your location, depends on your city, and depends on where you are, unquote. But adds that in their experience, it isn't any worse than other field apps they've used. Trump campaign political director James Blair says the reports of the glitch aren't accurate. All tech we are relying on is performing adequately. Any issues are immediately addressed, and of course, like any big organization, we have parallel backup systems as a fail-safe, he says. Mr. Blair says the Trump field program has already connected twice the number of hard IDs for Mr. Trump through field efforts than the entire 2020 campaign, with about 3 weeks to go until Election Day. We're really outperforming in every single battleground state, he says. And Mr. Musk's operation isn't the only one doing field work for Mr. Trump. Turning Point USA and the Christian Conservative Faith and Freedom Coalition are also out helping to turn out voters. But other Republicans aren't feeling as confident about the combined ground game effort, especially Mr. Musk's role. I'm pretty worried, says a GOP field specialist who ran a swing states field program for the RNC during a past Trump campaign. That strategist had been in touch with people involved in this year's ground game and said they saw symptoms of a, quote, thrown-together field program in Mr. Musk's efforts. Our next article comes to us from staff writer Howard LaFranchi and special correspondent Taylor Luck. They are reporting from Washington and Istanbul with a story titled Hamas Leader's Death Revives Hope for a Gaza Peace Plan. Is that enough? Just over a year ago, the Biden administration was pressing Middle East partners forward on a transformative plan for the region that would include normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia and a definitive pathway to a Palestinian state. Then Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar launched a surprise October 7 attack on Israel, one of his motivations being to scuttle an American peace plan that seemed increasingly imminent. A devastating war in Gaza, an expansion of the conflict to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and to Iran ensued. Now Mr. Sinwar has again shaken the region like an earthquake, this time with his death in a firefight last Wednesday with Israeli soldiers on patrol in Gaza. The question now is whether the October 7 mastermind's death might facilitate the Gaza ceasefire and hostages release deal the Biden administration has promoted for months, and even revive the grand regional plan. For many experts, the answer depends heavily on navigating both ambitious Israeli war goals and internal Palestinian divisions. Almost immediately Thursday, President Joe Biden signals his hope that removal of the Sinwar obstacle would jumpstart peace efforts. There is now the opportunity for a day after in Gaza without Hamas in power, and for a political settlement that provides a better future for Israelis and Palestinians alike, Mr. Biden said in a statement. Indeed, several Gulf Arab diplomats appeared Friday to want to jump on the Biden opportunity bandwagon, seeing a chance to advance the plan that had been grounded for months, and even to prevent an Israel-Iran war. But the president's optimistic assessment is most likely premature, many regional analysts and diplomatic experts say. If anything, some add, Mr. Sinwar's death is likely to lead to a reorganizational period for Hamas, while it could embolden Israel in ways that put off any resolution even further. Any advancement in plans by Arab states depends heavily on Israel's policy moving forward, says Hesham Al-Ghanem, Saudi political scientist and non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Middle East Center. If Israel sees this as an opportunity to further its objectives and continues its aggression on Gaza without concessions, as it did in the past, it will hinder Arab Gulf state efforts. There have been two preeminent decision makers in this conflict, Mr. Sinwar and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and I don't believe the disappearance of one is going to mean the necessary steps for ending this war are going to happen any more quickly, says Aaron David Miller, a longtime Middle East diplomat. It's not just a question of agreeing to a ceasefire and freeing the hostages, says Mr. Miller, who served in both Democratic and Republican administrations. Those things mandate critically important questions that won't be answered easily. Among them, what security authorities will exist in post-war Gaza that will ensure no resurgence of Hamas? What role will there be for Palestinian Authority? Will there be Arab countries' boots on the ground? For Mr. Miller, Mr. Biden's suggestion that Mr. Sinwar's removal opens a window to resolve the conflict underscores once again the issue of timing. The Hamas clock and the Netanyahu clock are not running as quickly as the Biden administration's, and it's just not realistic to think that Sinwar's death has done anything to synchronize these clocks, he says. This is a moral issue and a legacy issue for a president who had hoped to resolve this before leaving office, notes Mr. Miller, now a senior fellow in U.S. foreign policy at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's very different from the considerations motivating the next steps of either Netanyahu or an organization taking time to consider its future. The demise of a key player whose overarching goal was the destruction of Israel will alter the course of the conflict, others say, but less than conclusively. Yes, this does present an opportunity for a shift, but at best it's going to be a change to a different phase in the Gaza piece of this, says Seth Jones, president of the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. This doesn't bring an end to anything. The opportunity, he sees, is for the Israelis, specifically Mr. Netanyahu, quote, to move into a phase that is more diplomatic and starts to address these big governance and security questions hanging over Gaza, unquote. Some with insight into both U.S. and Israeli politics agree that the moment presents an opportunity, but they doubt that Mr. Netanyahu is ready to subordinate his domestic political considerations in order to seize it. This should be an opportunity to advance the Biden initiative, which envisions a resolution of long-standing regional issues, says Nimrod Novik, a former Israeli government official and Israel fellow with the Israel Policy Forum in Washington. But the cork in the bottle for all of this is Gaza, he says, and if you don't uncork Gaza, you can't get to the rest. But, he says, that would imply doing things in Gaza, including much more extensive humanitarian assistance and some role for the Palestinian Authority that couldn't pass muster with part of Mr. Netanyahu's government. Unfortunately, for Netanyahu, his coalition is more precious than even bringing back the hostages, he says. And nothing suggests a desire in the government coalition to move forward with the Americans. Bezalel Smotrich, a far-right cabinet minister, posted on social media platform X shortly after Sinwar's death was confirmed that he, quote, hears the talk abroad about an opportunity to end the war from those who tried to pressure us to stop the war a long time ago and stop us from entering Rafah, unquote. If they are aiming right now at a surrender deal in which Israel dumps the achievements of the war that were bought with a lot of blood, I tell them to forget about it, he wrote in the post. Still, some Israeli analysts hold out hope that the government can move beyond its most extreme members to seize the moment. Shimrit Meir, who advised former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, is among those also urging Mr. Netanyahu's government to take advantage of the void in Hamas leadership. Sinwar was a symbol of the de facto leader of Palestinian national movement. He was the kind of leader you see once in a generation. The fact that he's gone allows for a reshuffling of the cards, she told the Israeli podcast, Unholy. Meanwhile, Arab Gulf states on Friday were pitching the day after plan not only as the off-ramp to the Israel-Hamas war, but as a key to easing regional tensions. Sinwar's killing gives us momentum. There are no Hamas hardliners standing in our way, says an Arab Gulf diplomat who was not authorized to speak to the press. But the ball is now in Netanyahu's court. The main components for the day-after plan for Gaza have all been agreed upon by us Gulf states, the EU, and the Americans, the diplomat said. A technocrat Palestinian Authority entity, no Hamas in government, Gulf-funded reconstruction, and security guarantees for Israel. Although Arab states have been holding high-level discussions with Israel over the initiative for months, we have been given conflicting messages from the Israeli government whether Israel supports the plan or is ignoring it completely, the diplomat added. That assessment does not take into account continuing indecision and disagreement among key Palestinians on how to move forward. While the main five Arab states involved, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar, are unanimous on the plan, infighting among Palestinian factions has hindered the final talks over any new Palestinian governing entity. The internal Palestinian political landscape, marked by factionalism and infighting, serves as a significant barrier, says Dr. Al-Ghanem, the Saudi analyst. These divisions not only complicate immediate post-war governance and security arrangements, but also hinder the broader objective of creating a sustainable, unified Palestinian state or administrative entity, he says. Most experts see Israel pursuing its military operations in Gaza and against Hezbollah in Lebanon, no matter how much the U.S. promotes the moment as providing an off-ramp from war. But if Mr. Netanyahu does decide to shift at least partially to a more diplomatic phase, he's going to need the backing of the Americans for moving forward, Dr. Jones of CSIS says. The Israelis are going to continue their operations, whether they see security at stake, no matter what Washington says. But where the Israelis are going to need help is that point where Mr. Netanyahu decides he's ready to think about what's next in Gaza, he says. It's not at all clear yet when he's going to be ready to take up those broader issues. Now let's return to the United States for an interesting article titled, What's Engaging These High Schoolers? Classes about the election. This article comes to us from staff writer Jackie Valley. Lawson Waldrop used to have a spotty attendance record. So far this academic year, the 12th grader in Bar Harbor, Maine, says she has barely missed a day of school. What's the gravitational pull bringing her to class? A 9-week elective course all about the upcoming election. It feels like the most important class to me, says Lawson, who turned 18 over the weekend. English is cool and all, but this is like real world stuff that I need to know, especially because I'm going to be partaking in the election. Every 4 years, the presidential election energizes civics education. It presents a natural opportunity for educators to discuss topics such as the Electoral College, campaign finance, and the policy issues being debated, even if they say it has gotten trickier in recent years. Nearly a third of principals surveyed in August by EdWeek Research Center say a, quote, challenging or very challenging obstacle to civics education has been the notion that it's too political or controversial. Still, experts say learning about elections and the democratic process can lead to greater civic engagement among young people. A fringe benefit, though, may be student engagement. In an age of chronic absenteeism, some educators are finding that leaning into election topics piques students' interests and keeps them motivated to learn. When students have a chance to talk about their identity and values, it brings engagement both inside and outside the classroom, says Adrian Billingham Bach, Director of Curriculum and Implementation for the Harvard University-based Democratic Knowledge Project. The group partners with educators to co-design civics lessons. Students see and are able to really bring who they are and what matters to them into the classroom, she says. We know that that supports authentic civic engagement as well. It's also a chance for students to learn about the nuts and bolts of the election process itself. In 2022, less than a quarter, 22%, of eighth graders demonstrated civics proficiency on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, known as the Nation's Report Card. The relatively low percentage underscores what educators and civics advocates say is a concerning trend for democracy in the United States as a whole. In Bar Harbor, Maine, the election year class debuted this fall at Mount Desert Island High School. It joined the school's roster of other niche electives, such as courses on the Holocaust, Civil War, Vietnam War, forensics, astronomy, and outdoor science. It's not that they're not rigorous, but it's not your typical world history or chemistry or something that everybody takes, Principal Matt Haney says. If you signed up for this class, it's because you're interested in it. It gets to be a great learning environment when everybody wants to be there. More than 2,000 miles to the west, Principal Katie Law is deploying a similar strategy at Arapaho Charter High School in Arapaho, Wyoming. The school serves about 55 students, most of whom belong to the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes. Since taking on the leadership role nearly 7 years ago, Ms. Law has been on a mission to boost student attendance and ultimately the school's graduation rate. The former social studies teacher has found that emphasizing the upcoming election and preparing eligible students to vote has helped. She encourages her students to be informed voters. You're not going to be informed if you're not coming to school, Ms. Law says. Last month, her students watched and analyzed the debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris. Beforehand, they jotted down the issues they hoped to hear discussed, and afterward reflected on what the candidates actually debated. Information about local candidates, tribal elections, ballot initiatives, and the U.S. party system plays a role in the educational run-up to the election, too. Ms. Law also asks students to think about their own values and causes. She says many point to issues such as mental health or missing and murdered indigenous people. In mid-October, eligible students, based on age and tribal enrollment, participated in a tribal primary election. The grand finale, of course, comes on election day itself. Ms. Law says students who are 18 years or older plan to cast their ballots at the school campus, which is a polling location, and then visit a bigger voting center to see the buzz on November 5th. For a previous election, students dressed in tribal-inspired clothing, voted at a county courthouse, posed for photos afterward, and then stopped at Starbucks for a post-vote treat. It's the culmination of an effort that Ms. Law hopes will pay dividends for her students throughout their lives. If you want your voice heard or you want change, step one is voting, she says. While the election may be a hook for student engagement, the classroom can also provide a safe forum for children and teens to discuss their views and learn from their peers' perspectives as well. The polarized national discourse certainly may cause some hesitation among teachers to dive into those discussions, says Ms. Billingham Bach of the Democratic Knowledge Project. I also think that civics teachers really know that part of their responsibility is to teach about elections and to set agreements on how we talk to one another in our community, she says. Ilana Diaz, who teaches the election year course in Maine, says she and her teaching assistant, Megan Letty, strive to model civil discourse. They bounce ideas back and forth during classroom discussions, and the duo hasn't shied away from thorny topics like how the Israeli-Hamas war or immigration policy may affect upcoming elections on the national, state, and even local levels. As for engagement, Ms. Diaz credits the student-driven nature of the class with helping. She crafts lesson plans around what students already know, want to know, or where their interests lie. Even if the candidates sometimes themselves avoid doing so, Isa Raven, a 12th grader who is taking the course, says analyzing the recent Trump-Harris debate ended in disappointment. I felt like both Trump and Harris would make a point about their policy, but then they just go off and they'd start insulting each other, she says. The 17-year-old can't vote in this year's election. Even so, she still wanted to hear more about the candidates' plans if elected. Isa says she appreciates that the course encourages thoughtfulness and discussion as opposed to certain core subjects where students are just chasing a high grade. This is nice, she says, because we can be like, okay, the debate was last night. Let's just chat about it. And that brings us to the conclusion of our reading today. I thank you very much for joining me for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglowitz, and as always, I wish you a most pleasant, safe, and healthy day. And we invite you to please stay tuned for our next regularly scheduled program.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.